This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to be down here. It's my first trip to Australia, and I am made very much aware that I am not a Robinson Crusoe here because everybody's been so friendly and so accommodating. All right, let's begin. I am going also to begin with a quote. A tall, dark, handsome stranger has come into my life and gone, a California newspaperman once jocularly wrote in the early 1950s. A friend reportedly asked, "Now what nationality would you say that man was?" That cultured accent, that deportment, those Cary Grant good looks and dash which marked a citizen of the world belonged to Howell Walker, who happened to be traveling in California on a National Geographic assignment. He left that same impression on nearly everybody he ever met. An example. In December 1953, alongside a National Geographic colleague, Howell Walker was covering the royal visit of Queen Elizabeth II to Fiji and Tonga. In Fiji, the press corps was all shacked up in one large tent. One morning, Elliot Elisoffen of Life magazine awoke, pushed back his mosquito netting, looked around him, and declared, "Well, here we are, all 21 of us, 19 journalists and two gentlemen from the Geographic." Howell Walker, once described as the society's perfect gentle knight, was indeed the epitome of a gentleman. In an unruffled and Princetonian way, the California newspaperman continued, Walker investigated and reported on far-off, rugged places in the National Geographic manner. Just what was that National Geographic manner? To make a very long story very short, the National Geographic was founded in Washington, D.C. in 1888 for the increase and diffusion of geographic knowledge. We saw that the Smithsonian was founded for the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Increase and diffusion was a phrase everybody liked to use back then. It was founded largely by government scientists, but the early National Geographic Society tottered on the brink of bankruptcy for nearly a decade until a brilliant young editor, Gilbert H. Grosvenor, transformed its dowdy journal into a magazine of wide appeal by publishing photographs, especially color photographs, of exotic corners of the globe. Geography thus became geography broadly construed, the world and all that is in it, as Alexander Graham Bell, its second president, put it. That meant plants and animals joined the long parade of turbaned, tattooed, plumed, and feathered humanity that marched through the magazine's pages. Yet Grosvenor had Edwardian notions of propriety. Though he depended on contributors, many of whom might never be welcomed into a middle-class parlor, he needed his magazine to become a fixture there. So as he built the society into the organization we still recognize today, he cultivated dignity and respectability and demanded gentlemanly behavior of his staff men above all. By the 1930s, that dignity and respectability was embodied in stone and marble in the society's Washington, D.C. headquarters building. Located only 6 blocks from the White House, it had Italian Renaissance detailing, paneled offices, and segregated dining rooms, the women in one, the men in the other, because it was feared that men might tell off-color jokes in the presence of the ladies. Those ladies had to wear white gloves, and those gentlemen could not walk down the hall without donning their jackets. Ties, of course, were obligatory. Still, it was a fitting headquarters for an American institution. With over 1 million members, the National Geographic Society in the 1930s was the largest scientific and educational institution in the world. Its magazine was found in every school and doctor's office in the United States. That magazine, and it was always referred to with a capital M, enshrined the sense of dignity on the one hand and exotic adventure on the other. This was the classic oak leaf cover that identified it from 1910 to the end of the 1950s. The border of oak leaves and acorns, it was said, represented the origins and sturdy growth of the society, The garland of laurel at the top was the traditional crown of achievement in the arts. The hemispheres, northern, eastern, southern, and western, at the cardinal points suggested that the contents were indeed constrained only by the world and all that is in it. So established in the hearts of its members was this design that when photographs first erupted onto the cover in 1959, an Englishman was reported to have written, "If God had intended a picture on the cover of the National Geographic, he would have put one there in the first place." This, then, was the National Geographic that Howell Walker grew up with. Born Harrison Howell Dodge Walker on August 4, 1910, he came from an old and established Georgia family on his father's side and a New York one on his mother's. He was educated at St. Albans School in Washington and the Berkshire School in Sheffield, Massachusetts, before enrolling at Princeton University, where he was a track star as well as a 1933 graduate in languages. While other members of his class went on to become captains of industry and leaders of finance, Walker opted instead to be a walkabout magazine correspondent, a professional globetrotter. Of course, he didn't just stroll in and get the job. He was told when he first stepped into the Geographic's marble foyer to go away, you have no experience. So he went out and got some, spending the better part of the next 3 years traveling around the world. And as he wandered, he wrote, occasionally sending back material to the Geographic. The editors apparently liked what they saw. They conferred with the chief of the photo lab, who declared that the young man might be made into a passable professional photographer. Persistence paid off. On March 2, 1936, Howell Walker, 25, was hired on a three-month trial basis in the photo lab, the place where all aspiring young writer photographers started, wearing a smock with your name embroidered over the left-hand pocket, mixing chemicals in large earthenware crocks. He quickly proved himself in the field, though, and soon joined that elite corps of National Geographic triple threats, as they were called. Those men, and they were all men at this time, who could take the pictures, write the story, and make the 16-millimeter travelogue film for the Society's popular lecture series. Walker might have made a career producing such a late 30s period pieces as Adirondack Idylls and Gentle Folk Settle Stern Saguenay, alliteration being much favored at the time, were it not for the Second World War. In early 1941, he was sent to cover the war effort in Australia. It was just the luck of the draw. It might as easily have been Greenland, where one of his colleagues was posted. But those 5 years proved to be the most pivotal ones of his life. Initially, he was the exemplary correspondent, writing such articles as The Making of an Anzac and Life in Dauntless Darwin. Soon, however, he grew restless, peppering his dispatches with Big Yellow Full Moon so as to goad the censors. They would always delete it, despite the fact that the same Big Yellow Full Moon shone on the Japanese as it did on the Allies. Finally, after a month's tour with the U.S. Army Air Forces, he joined up. In April 1943 in Brisbane, he was commissioned a second lieutenant, serving thereafter as an intelligence officer with the 5th U.S. Air Force all over the Southwest Pacific Theater from Australia to New Guinea and the Philippines. Eventually, he rose to the rank of captain. The war, however, was not his only Australian complication. Sheila Gordon Anderson was the daughter of the prominent Sydney businessman and retired brigadier general. Howell met her in 1942, and before the year was over, they were married. After the war, he brought his bride back to Washington and resumed his life as a National Geographic roving correspondent. Only now he had a beat. Whereas the magazine already had its Latin American man and Middle East man, Howell Walker now became its Australia man. Soon enough, he was back here. The war had scarcely ended before Charles Mountford was touring the U.S. showing his films on Aboriginal life. As we have heard, Grosvenor and his editors were enchanted by them, and the upshot was that they invited Mountford to apply for a National Geographic research grant. Expeditions might have many beginnings, but that was certainly an important one for this one. Howell Walker was to accompany the Arnhem Land expedition as the Geographic's representative and photographer. Of the tons of equipment the American members alone brought, Walker's share, except for the better part of 5 miles of color film, was low for the most part. Cases of still film and a battery of cameras, large format Linhofs and Graflexes, medium format Rolleiflexes, and the 35mm Leicas that the magazine used almost exclusively for color were the common kit of the era. Peter Bassett Smith may have used a Bolix, and it's on display here at the museum, but Howell, as we see in this picture, used a Kodak Cine Special movie camera. And last but not least, of course, he also brought a portable typewriter. He filed dispatches back to the office whenever he could, but news of expedition mishaps, not all of them accurate, filtered out anyway. 5 D.C. scientists reported marooned on Primitive Isle, ran the headline of the April 21st, 1948 Washington Post. That was when the rains and floods on Groot Island were at their worst. The only problem was 3 of those 5, Dave Johnson, Herbert Degnan, and Howell Walker, were nowhere near Groot Island. They were instead marooned on the 200-ton Phoenix, the supply ship stranded on a reef for 5 weeks. They eventually were rescued, of course, and a few months later, after the expedition had moved on to Darwin, I think it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, Howell remained behind on Groot Island to catch up on photography. In August, he clambered aboard Fred Gray's catch, Wanderer 2, and promptly went missing again. A search and rescue mission by the Australian Air Force finally located Wanderer 2 holed up in an obscure harbor due to rough seas. But that also landed on the front page of the Washington papers. I feel genuinely sorry and not a little sheepish about the reported missing incidents, Howell wrote back to headquarters. But in those marble halls, unknown to him, he was already being dubbed the intrepidest explorer because he was twice listed as missing. No other geographic man, it seems, had been listed as missing more than once. Wherever and whenever he caught up with the expedition, Howell, of course, had plenty of work to do. Geographic editors had shot lists, as they called them, the photographers were supposed to follow. Though most of the photographic heavy lifting was in black and white, there were establishing shots, for instance, which needed to be saturated with scenic color, quote unquote. Look kind of familiar? Take a look at the Frank Setzler picture on the cover of your program. Clearly, a morning was given over to posing for photographs. Move a few crates around, repose the people, make the cook wear his togs, switch out the Australian and American flags for a National Geographic one that dwarfs them both, and you have the version the magazine published. The editors like getting that flag in there. Those 3 stripes, by the way, were brown for land, green for sea, and blue for sky. Such color pictures were often posed not so much because imaginations were stilted, as because early Kodachrome, as you photographers know out there, was very slow. It had an ASA rating of 8. Modern digital cameras are at least 10 times as fast. The Geographics editors also wanted landscape shots, but they demanded that people appear in the scene. The presence of people, they claimed, gave scale to geography. They even called it, quote, humanized geography, unquote. What's more, those people were usually garbed in red. Red shirts, red scarves, red sweaters. Because when Kodachrome was first released in the mid-30s, it was believed that the inclusion of some red in a picture helped make colors pop. Well, that was taken to extremes at the Geographic, where photographers were instructed to carry in their kit red scarves and sweaters, giving rise to what was later sneeringly called the Red Shirt School of Photography. Thankfully, Howell must have left those scarves and sweaters at home, because they would really have looked kind of funny in Arnhem Land. It was said that the Geographic man always traveled first class, stayed in the finest hotels, and because he was expected to be a gentleman, always carried a black tie. Well, here's the Geographic gentleman in Australia. On the edge of Inyalark Hill at Owen Pelly, I believe it is to be exact, a Robinson Crusoe in Arnhem Land is what the caption actually says. But the image does have its idyllic quality. There is his alfresco office, his bed, his rolled-up mosquito net, his satchel, his portable typewriter, his lamp. There's even some rock art to gaze at on the ledge above him. In this outdoor bedroom, with the rains long past, Walker could fall asleep each night with a Southern Cross etched on his fluttering eyelids. To his colleagues back at headquarters, however, this image evoked freedom. Not only freedom from the strictures of society, but from one society, capital S, in particular. At the clean-cut National Geographic, where all the ladies wore white gloves and even mustaches were frowned upon, here was its Cary Grant, Howell Walker, with a beard. This was permitted, of course, on expeditions, but it is hard to imagine today, when beards are commonplace, how much attention they attracted back then. The caption writers could never resist pointing out the deficiencies of barbering in remote places. Still, the picture was used in an advertising appeal a year or so later. Under the title, "Have Typewriter, We'll Travel," it stated that 8 months in Arnhem Land, quote, "can't help but bring out a flair for improvisation in anybody," unquote. Even today, for those few people at the National Geographic who still recognize the name Howell Walker, it is this image that comes to mind. In subsequent years, Walker often returned to Australia. In 1954, he journeyed to Melville Island with Mountford in a kind of sequel to the 1948 Arnhem Land expedition. Before his retirement in 1975, he wrote at least 5 more National Geographic stories on various Australian topics. In a poll among the secretaries, he was also voted, even when his hair had gone all silver, the man with whom they would most like to be stranded on a desert island. He left them disappointed because he and Sheila settled permanently in Australia, spending the last 2 decades of their lives together in an art-filled home in Woollahra. Before he died at 92, on January 26, 2003, Howell Walker, once the epitome of the geographic gentleman, was sporting a bushy white beard. And you can see a picture of that on page 43 of your program.
Now, I'd like to open it to some questions. We still have a bit of about 5 minutes for questions or comments, and remind you that to identify yourself when you grab the mic. Louise Hamby.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. And being an American, I have that sort of same kind of feeling about the National Geographic always being there. But my question is, what today does the National Geographic Society itself hold from the expedition?
Oh, from this expedition?
Yes.
Pictures. That was almost, generally speaking, that was the deal whenever there was a big expedition. We did a lot of things with the Smithsonian, for instance, in the 30s, 40s, 50s. They would get the collections, we would get the pictures. We would get the film. That was sort of our deal. We didn't have the facilities for keeping collections. So that was almost always the deal. We got the pictures. We sent a guy, usually one of our staff professional photographers, to go down there and get them. And everybody else got the collections they needed, because they were more properly museums and research
centers.
Did
you also get any photographs from any of the other expedition members, or are they just Howell Walkers?
Well, most of them were Howell Walkers, and I don't know. Martin might know whether some other strays got in there, but yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe you should add that there are the manuscripts, the drafts of the articles.
Oh, yes.
There's Hal wrote an article of his trip up Roper River.
Right.
With Jerry Blitner.
Right.
And Fred Gray.
Right. We have
that, in fact, never got published.
Yeah, there's a lot.
So there are some gems.
There's tons of paper, of course, and there are tons of manuscripts for articles that didn't get published and anything else that had direct relevance to the National Geographic magazine or its research committee. So there's a considerable archive, but it's largely a picture or a paper archive, and we have a very slim collection of artifacts.
Okay,
thank you. I got the wrong one. Bill Carney.
When I was in the state, the place Boston, while we went to the museum, we were chasing after the Australian artefacts. Same time in a tour, when it was the tour trade show, we were doing the international trade show. Now, I saw a lot of African one and a lot of New Guinea, but we was asking for Australian one because they knew we were the Australian. They had it hidden, I think. And Washington State is the same. Mm. And they have some because many tools gone away from our country, hidden somewhere, and we can't find it.
Huh.
You know, it's still gone. But Washington State has got some, and they got it. I know because I work with a lady in the bush medicine gather-up, and she's one of the counselors in the museum in Washington State. You know, that's why I come to know about it.
Uh-huh. Well, things end up in funny places sometimes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. You're on next anyway. So, you want one for Mark? Sorry.
I want to congratulate the National Museum for getting Hal Walker's film, which we have seen several times on the screen.
We're going to talk about
that
tomorrow.
I was lucky, and my family were lucky, in 1956 to have a private celebration in the National Geographic, and we were shown that film. In 1998, for the 50th year, Hal Walker and myself tried to get the film into Australia, and now we have it.
There you go. Well.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for that, Mark, and for coming such a long. That's great. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.